This episode of Connect the Dots is brought to you by the Center for Progressive Reform. Our podcast is supported in part by the Center on Environment, Land, and Law at Loyola University, New Orleans. Years ago, when my life was upended by Hurricane Katrina, I decided to spend most of what I do professionally on one big thing: helping communities prepare for the impacts of climate breakdown. Now, that's scary, I know. And look what we've been through in the last 6 months or so. A drought that's still baking Central California. The Dixie Fire that tore through Northern California in July. Hurricane Ida that flattened many neighborhoods in southern Louisiana. And then the remnants of that caused flash floods in New Jersey and in New York, among other places. Climate change is making events like these more probable and more powerful. Now, we've got to cut greenhouse gas emissions to avoid the risks that we can't manage, but we also need to start managing the risks that we can't avoid. Now, at my school at Loyola University New Orleans, I teach a course about disaster law and global warming. And on the first day, I start with an icebreaker. It's an exercise I call Escape from Climate Change. And so I tell the students, I say, take rising seas, hotter summers as a given. Now, that's bad news for warm coastal cities like San Diego. It's bad news for New Orleans. So imagine you live in a city like that and you want to escape. Where would you go? Someone always picks Seattle. It's wet and clammy, they say, and hey, in the future, maybe you'll be growing oranges. Nope, sorry, I say, in Western Washington State, they are losing snowpack to warmer weather. And local counties are panicked over water shortages. Did I mention that the region is also overdue for a massive earthquake and tsunami? Okay, so sometimes a student says, Rapid City. It's far from the coast. Hey, plus it's close to the Sturgis motorcycle rally. But South Dakota's Black Hill Forests are drying up, I tell them, increasing wildfire risk by 600%. You'll need more than a biker bandana to keep the smoke out of your lungs from there. Alaska? No. The permafrost is softening and tribal villages are skidding into the sea and the soil is thawing. Scientists expect a release of millions of ancient bacteria to which humans have lost immunity. We are never going to outrun climate change, I tell my students. We have got to outsmart it. And the way to outsmart climate change is to build climate resilience. And that means inventing ways to cope with and recover from climate impacts while maintaining the capacity to learn, adapt, and thrive. Now, depending on circumstances, resilience like this might require restoring natural protective features like sand dunes or barrier reefs, or maybe building artificial ones like levees. You might have to fortify roofs, widen storm drains, update the power grid, all kinds of things like that. And yes, sometimes it's going to mean retreating from places that can't be saved. And that's happening, sadly, in Alaska Native villages, for instance, that I mentioned above. So in the first episode of this season, I've been thinking about where and how we should all be living. Whether you're building a home, renovating a fixer-upper, or even renting, there are new risks to consider other than the price depreciation and unexpected repairs. So you got to factor in climate change and all its long-term consequences. So that beach condo, it might not be the prime property location for you. Some real estate agencies are going so far as to create warning labels on their listings. Yet in many of these markets, home prices are actually increasing. Do buyers not understand the risk? Maybe they don't care. When the future is uncertain and the threat is unknown, major life decisions get tricky. Build, buy, rent, move, no matter what you do, you are rolling the dice. And because of climate change, those dice are loaded.
You see that the number of homes being listed in these more sea level rise exposed markets is just continuing to grow. But meanwhile, buyers are snatching up fewer of them. So the sellers still want to sell their home. They keep the list prices high, so they think they can sell them at the same price. But the buyers are just saying, no, they're not interested anymore.
When climate change hits, it's going to take a hit to our overall housing stock. There are going to be some homes that are just uninhabitable or go down in value, and that's going to push up prices for the homes that are resilient. So if we keep going in this direction, it's going to become a luxury good to live in a place that is resilient to climate change.
I want to live in America where we, just as food has a nutrition label, there are labels on housing that if you rent this place, you face this fire risk, this PM 2.5 risk, this flood risk.
You're listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. This season, we're taking a look at climate resilience, managing and recovering from climate impacts. The crisis is serious, but there are things we can do to learn, adapt, and thrive. Today, we begin our discussion with the real estate market and the climate risks affecting the places and spaces that we call home. Now, buying a home is inherently stressful. There's no way around it. My wife and I, we've owned 4 different homes. And this last one, which we love, was flooded, as I said, during Hurricane Katrina. After a lot of work, we're good now. Thanks for asking. But there are countless factors that you have to consider when you buy a house and when you're maintaining it. You've got to think about renovations, interior design, location, market fluctuations, mortgages, and insurance rates. It's an investment, but if you're smart, it can be a lucrative one. Most people buy where they feel the value is going to appreciate over time, an up-and-coming neighborhood in a popular city maybe, or someplace with a view, and that only gets more desirable. The thing is that many places that would have been desirable in the past are now experiencing the impacts of the climate crisis. Wear and tear is setting in, not to mention there are long-term consequences to exposure. Think about a place like Brooklyn, New York's hippest borough, and an undeniably expensive one. The streets there flood in severe storms, and subways fill up with water, suffocating commuters. In early September 2021, Hurricane Ida, I told you about that, they dropped as much rain in Central Park in an hour, 3.15 inches, as Chicago typically gets the whole month of September. More than 50 people died. Storms are getting stronger, they're getting more spontaneous, which is referred to as rapid intensification, and cities simply don't have enough time to prepare. Rapid intensification also influences hurricane forecasting. It's getting harder and harder to judge the threat. Meteorologists can predict where a storm might go, but it's harder to predict how strong it's going to be. Then there's Miami, the epitome of luxury and glamour, where many of its neighborhoods are flooded even when the sun is shining. Cities like Seattle and Portland, Oregon, which rarely see extreme heat, saw temperatures over 100 degrees for weeks this summer. In California, more than 3,000 homes and buildings were damaged or destroyed in those western fires I told you about. No matter where you land, you face uncertainty under the skies. In terms of real estate, damages from these natural disasters are hitting record highs. Floods, hurricanes, mudslides, wildfires, they cost hundreds of billions of dollars in damage in the United States. Accordingly, some investment companies have begun to emphasize the risk of climate change and create mitigation strategies. These include portfolio diversification, mapping of risk, incorporating adaptation and mitigation measures for assets at risk, and engaging with policymakers. And there are businesses that are standing by to assist in all of this. You have probably heard of Redfin. That's a real estate brokerage site and a tech behemoth. By the end of 2020, Redfin helped customers buy or sell more than 310,000 homes at a value worth more than $152 billion. This year, Redfin began grading its listings for climate risk, giving each home a ranking based on scores for things like fire, flood, storm, drought, and heat. I spoke with Redfin's chief economist, Daryl Fairweather, to learn about the impetus and the methodology.
If you were to look at our neighborhood pages, if you go to Redfin and you look up I don't know, Seattle, for example, or even like Brooklyn, New York, for example, you would see data from Climate Check on the overall climate risks. And that's for heat, drought, wildfire, sea level rise, and also storms. The flood data is at the property level. There's a lot of variation even within a zip code for how much a property is at risk for flooding. If you're at the top of the hill, you're going to have a lot less risk than if you're at the bottom of the hill. So that data is at the property level. For things like heat risk or drought, wildfire could be more at the property level, and that may be coming soon. But for now, that's at the neighborhood level. For the flood data, it's a model that incorporates historical data, but also projections into the future.
Redfin scores are calculated using advanced technology and analytical tools, and also factor in climate resilience. If an area affected by one of those risks has taken steps to counter or mitigate the hazards, it's going to score better. Some cities have already established better practices for dealing with climate disruption.
I remember I was looking at Phoenix, Arizona, and I was expecting to see a really high drought score. But because Phoenix has been dealing with drought for a very long time, they already have a lot of the infrastructure in place to deal with that. For example, people don't have green lawns in Phoenix anymore, and they're already been doing water rationing there and putting the infrastructure in place so that the city as a whole isn't using as much water as it may have in the past. But if you look just over to Maricopa, Maricopa does have high drought risk because it doesn't have that same resiliency.
The real estate site also researches trends in migration to analyze where people are moving to and where they're leaving. According to Daryl, people are actually relocating to areas with the highest climate risk. That's right. And they're leaving places with less risk. That's exactly the opposite of what people should be doing.
More people are moving to places like Florida or Arizona or Colorado. Colorado has really high drought risk. Austin has seen a huge amount of migration this last year, and home prices have shot up 40% in just 1 year. I mean, the good thing about Austin is that there's a lot of land, so hopefully they can absorb this growth better than a city like San Francisco has. But they're going to definitely have some huge challenges. Florida overall has seen an increase in migration, but Miami was the number one migration destination out of any metro area. And Miami is on the coast, and a lot of those properties have very high flood risk. There has been gentrification in areas like Little Haiti, which is up on a hill. And that's probably something we'll see a lot of, is people being displaced.
The curious case of Florida. Now, the Sunshine State is, of course, known for its warm weather and endless stretches of beaches. From retirees to family caravans to college spring breakers, the people living in and visiting Florida soak up all the state has to offer. But Florida isn't only being flooded by new residents and tourists. Over 1 in 4 people living in Florida are at risk of some kind of flooding. Specifically, more than 1.5 million people are living in areas at elevated risk of inland flooding, while 3.5 million are at risk of coastal flooding. By 2050, we think an additional 1 million people are going to be projected to be at risk of sea level rise, which, thanks to climate change, is causing something called nuisance flooding, or sometimes sunny day flooding. This is when the tides spill out into the streets. The state currently has more than 3,600 square miles in the 100-year coastal floodplain, and by 2050, this area is projected to increase to 5,300 square miles. Plus, it's getting hotter. Scientists predict that the number of dangerous heat days per year in Florida will multiply in the next 2 decades. Now, all of this should affect real estate prices. Rising sea levels increase the chance of temporary flooding and pose a threat that ultimately a property could end up underwater. Philip Mulder and his team at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania have been studying the impacts of sea level rise in real estate markets. They're trying to track fluctuations in housing and mortgage prices. According to Philip, however, many people are overlooking these future climate risks.
From 2001 to 2013, these coastal parts of Florida, all within a half mile of the coast. They follow each other really closely in terms of the number of home sales, so the home sale volume, as well as home sale prices. You know, they rise a lot during the housing boom, fall really sharply during the bust, and then begin to recover, really following each other along parallel lines. But then in 2013, something suddenly changes. We see that home sale volume starts to decline, but only in those markets that would basically be almost completely underwater with 6 feet of sea level rise. Meanwhile, the markets that are sort of minimally exposed to sea level rise, they sort of continue their housing market recovery along the same trend as before. So suddenly this huge divergence opens up in sale volumes between these two markets. But then what's really interesting is that we don't see the same thing going on with home prices. Once again, the markets are following each other really closely over the housing boom and bust. And then in 2013, even as home sale volume starts to plummet in these more sea level rise exposed markets, home prices continue to grow as if nothing's going on. It's only several years later, starting about 2016, that we finally see evidence that home price growth is starting to slow.
What Philip and his team have discovered is that in 2013, new information came out that put climate risk in the public eye. Hurricane Sandy, it hit New Jersey. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change had released its fifth assessment report addressing worst-case sea level rise scenarios. And additional reports revealed regional economic impacts of climate change. The headlines were really scary. Google searches for sea level rise spiked in Florida during that period. Still, prices stayed the same.
So our first thought is maybe this has something to do with lenders. So maybe lenders are the ones who are becoming savvy about risk. You know, they have all these models in the background. They're looking at their credit risk and exposure on 30-year mortgages. And so maybe they're tightening credit. And so it's becoming harder to get a loan. And so fewer homes are selling. But the thing is, when we looked at these mortgage outcomes, we didn't really see much evidence that it's the lenders. We see really similar declines in the number of cash purchases and the number of mortgage home purchases. So you would expect to see, if it were lenders tightening credit, a bigger decline in mortgage volume rather than all cash purchases. We don't see evidence that lenders are starting to deny more borrowers in these sea level rise exposed areas. And we don't see much evidence that they're increasing their rate of securitization.
So as it would turn out, it's the sellers. They want a return on their investment and don't see any reason why they shouldn't make a profit. At this point, the beaches, they're still sparkling.
In 2013, you see that the number of homes being listed in these more sea level rise exposed markets is just continuing to grow. But meanwhile, buyers are snatching up fewer of them. So the sellers still want to sell their home. They keep the list prices high, so they think they can sell them at the same price. But the buyers are just saying, no, they're not interested anymore. And then it's only later in 2016, 2017, that the number of listings finally starts to slow, that list prices finally start to come down. And that's when we see the home prices finally start to decline.
Now, there's another factor to consider here, one written in the subtext. Who are these buyers and sellers? What other opportunities do they have, and what protections are accessible to them? Some people can afford to rebuild their home or add stability to the infrastructure. Some people have more than one home. Not everyone plays the same hand when it comes to risk. Now, to be a climate resilient society, we have to consider everybody. People make individual decisions on where they want to live and how they want to live, but think less about how someone else's arrangements might change their own. Climate change strikes across the board, and as usual, those who are already struggling get hit the hardest. In terms of housing, it's become a matter of who can afford to stay, who can afford to leave, and who has no option but to suffer. I read on CNBC about a guy in Miami whose garage flooded daily. That nuisance flooding I was telling you about. And as a result, he'd already spent about $250,000 in renovation costs to make his home more resilient. When asked, the man said that he'd never leave. It was just too beautiful. Now, I understand this. When you've created a life somewhere, it's hard to be pulled away. This is a privileged choice to make, though. Resilience fixes are a commodity for the wealthy. And so, as it turns out, is home ownership. Again, here's Daryl Fairweather.
Housing policy is 100% climate policy. We should definitely be thinking through how to make housing more affordable in the places that are going to be the most resilient. Unfortunately, we're starting from a place where there aren't enough homes for everybody who wants one, and that's why home prices have been shooting up. That's why people have been leaving expensive coastal areas for more inland areas where homes are more affordable, but then home prices go up in those more affordable areas, and it's just like a cascade. I hate to be a pessimist, but we've already been struggling with our housing policy for so long. We built fewer homes in the last decade than we did in any decade going back to the 1960s. And when climate change hits, it's going to take a hit to our overall housing stock. There are going to be some homes that are just uninhabitable or go down in value, and that's going to push up prices for the homes that are resilient. So if we keep going in this direction, it's going to become a luxury good to live in a place that is resilient to climate change. And a lot of the most climate resilient homes are just going to shoot up in value and be something only that rich people can afford. From a policy perspective, we should be making that as easy as possible. If somebody wants to leave a climate risky area like coastal Louisiana, for example, to move to Wisconsin or Minnesota, I think that we should be facilitating that and making it easy for people to do that so that they don't end up stuck in harm's way. But there are going to be some people who want to stay behind, and if they have the money to do that, then I think that they should be the ones who bear that cost. But for people who don't have the money, they may need some intervention and some assistance.
Here we see the intersection of climate change and environmental justice. Miami Beach exemplifies this dichotomy, a home to some of the richest people in America and also to some of the poorest. Many immigrants live in neighborhoods around the city where nuisance flooding is so bad that sewage backs up into their homes. There's little in the way of protection. Flooding is the most common and expensive natural disaster in the United States, according to FEMA. 90% of all natural disasters in the United States involve flooding, and just 1 inch of water can cause $25,000 of damage to a home. It may come as no surprise that it's hard to get flood insurance.
This is one researcher, Matt Kahn, out of University of Southern California, and he's done a lot of research and work into climate adaptation. We're very good at adapting, but adapting costs money, and it's something that really only wealthy people are able to do. I think that the future of a city like Miami might be that Miami is only a place where the ultra wealthy can live, the people who are able to put their homes on stilts, or maybe it becomes some kind of a floating city. I mean, it's hard to predict the limits of our adaptation, and it's going to be the poor people who end up getting priced out because you have to put all this money into housing just to make it resilient, and they can't afford housing once all that money is put into it, or they have to relocate to a different area. So it's just going to exacerbate inequality.
I decided to speak with Matt Kahn myself and learn more about his work. He's the Provost Professor of Economics at the University of Southern California, and also the author of a new book called Adapting to Climate Change.
I'm not worried about Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk in adapting to climate change. They will use their resources to protect themselves. Imagine a poor family in New Orleans who has its social networks in a place that is at risk, whether it's the Sixth Ward or other areas that were pummeled by Katrina. For a poor family with social networks tied to a place, they want to remain in that risky place. Hurricanes are worsening the city's municipal finances. For poor cities and for Black majority cities, when natural disasters hit, these cities' local public finances and their local public services decline. And we, as a fair, rich society, owe it to this group to protect them. When you flip a coin, we kind of know that there's a 50% chance of a heads and a 50% chance of tails. In a place like Miami or in New Orleans, if I went up to a homeowner and said, what do you think is the probability there's going to be a major flood or event in the next 5 years, in the next 10 years? This is called ambiguous risk. What I think we're beginning to see in housing markets is this unsettling feeling, whether it's homes in a fire zone in the American West or whether it's homes in flood zones in the South, of this ambiguity of the risk. When home buyers are unsure about risks, it can make, I wouldn't be surprised if markets freeze up and if there's fewer bids for these homes, because it's rational to wait for more information to learn. You might want to rent the property for a while rather than locking into a 40-year investment.
Sometimes, as Daryl suggests, it depends on the home itself.
For fire-prone areas, and this was in California, home prices have been growing more slowly in the highest risk areas and then the lowest risk areas. And that's started around 2017, that the low risk area prices started to go up faster than the high risk areas. But for flood, it was the opposite. And I think the reason that home prices in flood prone areas are outpacing the prices in the low flood risk areas, because a lot of these flood risk homes are luxury homes. They're the coastal homes, the mansions on the sea. And in the last year, luxury housing has really taken off because the pandemic has been so unequal, and many people who are on the high end of the income spectrum have actually seen their incomes rise. And that's why luxury housing has become even more valuable. I could see home values in the most flood-prone areas continuing to rise, even as flooding gets worse, because those homes are going to be invested in. If you have a multi-million dollar mansion on the sea, it doesn't seem like that big of a cost to spend $100,000 putting your home on stilts. Whereas if you have a $100,000 home that is in a flood risk area, you're not going to make that investment. You're probably just going to abandon the home and move somewhere else.
And what else makes people take on these risks? Even if you can afford it, no one wants to lose money. For some people, it's still the less risky option that they have available. Others just weigh priorities differently.
There's a couple of different hypotheses that might explain this. Are they naive about the risks they face? Are they aware of the risks, but find it so beautiful that this home is better than their next best alternative? Are they technological optimists who think that Elon Musk will invent some super stilt to elevate their house? When we see people take a risky bet, is it risky for them? Are they risk lovers? Are they technological optimists? And that's where the microeconomic research on climate change adaptation is going. Cities like Berkeley, California, San Francisco, Boston, Portland, Seattle build very little new housing. If potential destination areas do not build new housing, home prices are going to soar. Too much of America is zoned for single-family housing. In my libertarian fantasy for helping us to adapt to climate change, I want us to upzone. I want some of us to live at Hong Kong density. I grew up in New York City. There's a new set of climate data scientists identifying those areas that face less fire risk, less flood risk, less sea level rise risk. When we identify higher ground, if we can upzone in those areas, then people could move to these areas without home prices soaring in these relatively safe places.
There are additional pain points to consider when it comes to cost of climate resilience and real estate. For one, who pays for the damage when all these risks are realized? Then there's the higher costs associated with protecting cities and municipalities from threat. Miami is investing $200 million to upgrade infrastructure and install stations that pump out floodwaters, for instance. Miami Beach is spending twice as much to raise sidewalks and seawalls. This money's got to come from somewhere.
I believe in individual choice, and if somebody knows the risks and they still want to buy there, I'm not against that, as long as the costs that they are incurring fall on them. I mean, I think that's something we're going to have to think about as a society, like who pays for the climate damage. But something that we all pay for through higher taxes, then I probably will have a stronger opinion on where people decide to live. But if it's people's individual choices and they are taking on the cost at their own peril, then that's their decision to make.
And that's why Redfin and others are providing information to keep the public informed. Matt has a similar take on the situation. He views the debate with a lens of justice and believes fairness to citizens and equal basic rights should predicate such decision making.
I want to live in America where we, just as food has a nutrition label, there are labels on housing that if you rent this place, you face this fire risk, this flood risk. Imagine if there's three real estate developers who come up with the Cadillac plan of expensive, really climate-proofed housing. Scaredy cats like me would purchase that stuff, and rich cats would also. There would be a third level of housing, which is cheaper, which provides less insulation from Mother Nature's punches. And we know that that would self-select daredevils and poor people. There's an ethical issue. Poor people face the challenge of consuming the lowest quality goods, whether it's meat at the market, the schools they send their children to. I think climate change is going to exacerbate this. The poor's quality of life could decline if we don't embrace a Rawlsian perspective. And if we can build more housing, then rents would be lower and even poor people can move to higher ground.
The climate crisis has a way of complicating things. For housing, it's not just equipping your residents with proper walls and drains. There's also insurance to consider. Insurance is already really complicated, and layering climate change on top of that can be mind-numbing. No one really knows how bad the climate impacts are going to be and how fast they're going to arrive. Here again is Philip Mulder.
Actually, in many cases, risk rating 2.0 will be lowering premiums. Right now, there's a bunch of lines on the map around these floodplains where, you know, the estimated flood elevation sort of changes by a whole foot, or you go from being in the floodplain to out of the floodplain, all just on a single line. And so if you're on the high flood side of the line, you are going to be paying more than is probably actuarially fair than your expected risk. But if you're on the low flood side of the line, you're going to be paying less. Even if we look at the places that are currently being underpriced, there's even a cost to the residents of those places of these lower premiums. When we charge these low premiums or simply make these blanket statements that certain areas are uniformly low risk, we're sending information about risk that isn't accurate. And what I find is that this means that developers, when they're constructing in these areas, they don't elevate the homes as much. And often these areas do end up in the floodplain later, once the mapping updates and improves. And with sea level rise and increasing climate risk, even if these places are lower risk now, they might be higher risk in the future. Residents will buy these homes thinking that they're low risk. Then either they won't find out that they're in fact high risk, they'll choose not to buy flood insurance. And then when a flood happens, they're not insured. And when a flood happens, their home is less adapted, and so they suffer larger damages.
Philip compares the situation to the Affordable Care Act, which prevented medical insurers from denying coverage or hiking premiums on the basis of pre-existing conditions. Risks change rapidly. Conditions escalate. Some end up more tragic than others.
The rationale there is that when I buy a year-to-year insurance contract, I'm protecting myself against the risk that might happen to me in that year. But another risk that I face is that my risk is going to change over time. And that's a really tricky type of risk to insure because it requires me to enter into a long-term insurance contract. And one way to think about what's happened to these homeowners who have these homes that are essentially not viable anymore because their risk has changed, even though we can think about an efficient insurance market where, you know, this home has a 10% chance of flooding, and so you should pay $8,000 a year to insure your $80,000 home. The problem is that when they bought it, they thought that it should only cost $500 a year to insure that home. And so this is definitely a situation where we need to think about how to protect individuals against the chance that their risk might change over time. In some cases, that might look like an income support program where there would be vouchers for low-income individuals to buy flood insurance. When a home floods, it's inevitably a social issue because often the home, if it isn't repaired, that affects the neighborhood. And for it to get repaired, it often comes down to public financing. So from that perspective, if a family can't afford flood insurance, then, you know, a different arrangement should probably be found to make sure that the home in the event of a disaster would be prepared in a cost-effective way that still protects the owner from risk and the neighborhood allows for rapid recovery.
Like the COVID-19 pandemic, the public can't get on the same page with climate change. Despite research, statistics, and hard evidence, there is still a lot of disagreement about the scale of the problem and how much risk is really involved.
I think we're becoming increasingly certain that risk has increased substantially recently and is going to be increasing in the near term. But some of the greatest effects are probably still decades out. And so you might say, well, people disagree about these really long-term and highly uncertain risks. But then you look at a case like COVID and you say, well, this is, it's your own life. It's the life of the family and people that you love that's being put at danger. And yet we still see these really irrelevant factors that shouldn't affect the way that people respond to health information, very clearly driving the way that people respond to health information. So I think that this issue of polarization and how it affects the way people adapt to crises is, in fact, a very economically relevant issue.
As it turns out, insurance companies have influence even beyond telegraphing risk to home buyers through their premiums. Because communities need insurance companies to provide service, those companies are sometimes able to push local and state governments to adopt more protective building standards in order to contain the insurable risk. Sean Hecht, a law professor at UCLA and a member scholar at CPR, explains.
So there's a long history of the insurance industry advocating for building codes, doing other things along those lines. They don't want there to be losses. Their business is a business which relies on there being a certain amount of risk, and they want those risks to be manageable risks and risks that they can control for. And having a set of uniform building codes or other measures that control the risk is beneficial to them because then they're able to collect premiums and pay out on a more predictable basis without risking, really catastrophic things happen.
But when the risks get too big, private insurers will eventually leave the market. That's what happened with flood insurance. Then the federal government had to step in to pick up the slack. In exchange, the federal government created incentives for local communities to adopt stronger safeguards to contain the risk.
Since the mid-20th century, we've had relatively little private flood insurance in the U.S., and that's because of the issue of having highly correlated, high-magnitude losses. Insurers at some point discovered that, particularly in areas that were hurricane-prone, but really more generally, that it wasn't a sustainable model to insure against flood risk. Insurers just pulled out of that market. And when you buy an insurance policy for your house nowadays, you are insured against fire, but you're not insured against flood in the typical homeowner's insurance policy. And that's true throughout the country. The federal government stepped in with the National Flood Insurance Program, which provides a federal substitute for that. There is still some private flood insurance that's written on top of the federal program, in some cases instead of it. If you are a wealthy homeowner, you can go to an insurance broker and find an insurance carrier that's willing to underwrite just about any risk if you're willing to pay the premium for it. But for a typical homeowner, the National Flood Insurance Program is the core insurance. And within the National Flood Insurance Program, it's been very widely criticized for a number of reasons, including the fact that that flood insurance is required and premiums are set according to a set of maps of flood risk that are historically quite inaccurate and are becoming more inaccurate with climate change, which creates a lot of challenges for the program. There's also been a phenomenon where repetitive losses, the same property flooding over and over, continue to get payouts under the program. And that's a bug of the program that has been at least partially corrected by some recent legislative changes. What I was going to talk about is the community rating system, which is this program by which if a local jurisdiction, a city or town or county, imposes certain types of building and land use restrictions that reduce the risk of flood loss throughout their community, that everyone in that community then can get lower prices, lower premiums for the flood insurance that they have. And so in areas that are the very high flood risk areas where flood insurance is typically mandatory, In communities like that, people get to pay less for their mandatory insurance, and it creates an incentive for local governments to have building codes and zoning codes that create more restrictions.
The trouble is, communities still aren't doing enough to contain the risk, and there's a limit to what they can probably do. In the meantime, bigger storms and floods keep coming. Today, the National Flood Insurance Program is more than $20 billion in debt as a result. This is all the more reason that Matt thinks we should be renting. It avoids some of these complications and encourages better practices and financial gains, he says.
Most homeowners are amateurs. When something breaks in my house, I'm not really an expert at fixing things in my house. So I want more Americans to be renters. If more of us were renters, we would hold a more diversified portfolio. We'd face lower migration costs for leaving a place if it turns out to be riskier than we thought. And we'd be renting from a professional management company who would have the professionalism to actually do their job. I posit that profit-maximizing firms would have strong incentives to do their homework. When Amazon opened its HQ2s, when it did its national search for where to open its headquarters, it had every incentive to do its due diligence on whether its workforce would be happy and productive in the locations it was considering. And so that's an example of my arguing that forward-looking, profit-maximizing firms have strong incentives to do their homework about emerging risks. That flies in the face of what Thaler and other leading behavioral economists would claim. I don't want to live in the following world that features moral hazard. Matt purchases a beautiful million-dollar home, and if there isn't the flooding that Greta Thunberg predicts, I'm a rich man as it turns into a $3 billion home. If she's right and the end of days occur, I can just default on that loan. That's sort of an ugly option. And so I want to live in a world where mortgage lending companies do their homework and charge a higher interest rate, where insurance prices are higher and where interest rates are higher in riskier places, and where you can't get such a great loan-to-value ratio. If you had to put it down a down payment of 40%, you're more likely to do your due diligence before you put your life savings into this asset.
Nevertheless, Daryl Fairweather suggests that some Americans are stepping up to the plate.
We've done surveys and we found that nearly half, 49% of Americans who plan to move in the next year say that natural disasters or extreme temperatures factored into their decision to relocate. We also found that 3/4 of Americans are hesitant to buy homes in areas with climate risk. And 1 in 5 Americans believe climate change is already negatively impacting home values in their area. So from all of that, it seems like for the most part, people are very much aware of climate change and the risks that it poses to home values. But when you look at where people are moving, they're moving to the riskiest areas. So I think it's a factor that people are thinking about, but it's not the most important factor. And things like budget or being close to family or being in an area with mild winters seems to win out because those are much more tangible and present factors to consider, whereas climate change is in the future and it's abstract.
And Redfin is trying to accommodate them by providing more information and data that they need to make better decisions. I can understand this perspective too. I live most of the year in New Orleans. I consider that my home and I've been living here for years. I love New Orleans, but I'm well aware of the risks. I rode out Hurricane Ida in my house in August, and we lost power for several days. Now, the good news is I had a home generator, so I was able to keep the lights on and the food cold and help my neighbors who needed to store medicine in the refrigerator or charge their phones. But it was tough. There was a run on gasoline, and in some neighborhoods, the toilets wouldn't even flush because the electric pumps were out of commission. Anyway, I was curious about how my home held up in comparison to others, perhaps more unassuming places. So I asked Daryl to look up my neighborhood as it compared to hers. Do you own a home?
Yes. Yes, I do.
And where do you own your home?
I'm in Wisconsin. I'm in the Lake Geneva area of Wisconsin.
Oh, okay. So now, what's your score there? Do you know?
Where I am in Wisconsin has a 63 out of 100 storm risk, a 57 out of 100 heat risk, 24 out of 100 drought risk, and 20 out of 100 fire risk. And my particular home I know has a 1 out of 10 flood risk.
And that's okay with you. Those are good, tolerable scores, I'll say, huh?
The storm risk, I think, is the high. It's the highest score, and it's probably the most troubling. But with storm risk, at least from a resiliency perspective, there are things that I can do, like making sure that the water flows away from my house and doesn't end up flooding my basement, making sure my roof is in good shape. Heat risk, you can prepare for that with air conditioning. The fire risk was more troubling for me in Seattle. I just couldn't handle the smoke.
Yeah.
And the flood risk, I don't have any flood risk for my particular home. A lot of this comes down to like what risk you personally can tolerate. Mm-hmm. I understand why somebody might want to stay in California or the West Coast because they can tolerate the smoke. Maybe they put it in the HEPA filters on their HVAC system, or they have them installed in their home and they just stay inside when it's really smoky. I have 2 toddlers, so staying inside was very difficult during the smoky period, and I'd rather be somewhere with a different risk profile, even if it means I'm not completely immune.
Or yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, what people are used to. I mean, I grew up on the West Coast, and I got, if you want to say, used to earth tremors and an earthquake or whatever.
And you get used to it, not just as an individual, but also as a community. You start putting in building codes to make those buildings more resilient. So that's why I say, like, I wouldn't underestimate how much we can adapt to climate change. But, you know, some things are going to be more palatable adaptations to some people than others.
So the last thing I wonder if you can help me with. So I'm on the Redfin website, and I want to look at my climate rating for my house, or at least my neighborhood here in New Orleans. Is that an easy thing for you to show me how to do? If it's not, then that's fine too. But
yeah, let me just see real quick. So type in your zip code.
Okay. Yeah, my zip code is 70115, and I've just done that, and now I see a lot of homes at various prices in this area.
In the top right, it should say see market insights.
Oh, and this is okay.
Yeah, you should see your flood risk, and then it should have the different risk categories for heat, storm, drought, and fire there too.
Okay, so I'm going to read these out. Let's see, likelihood of flooding. Okay. Oh, well, but this is good. So I can see that 11,000 homes in my area have 100% flood risk within 30 years, which is the length of a standard mortgage. And then I look at heat, storm, drought, and so on. 74 out of 100 for heat risk, very high. 69 out of 100 for storm risk, very high. I just went through Ida, so I believe that. 8 out of 100 for drought risk, I believe that. And 0 out of 100 for fire risk, very low. Well, that makes me feel better. I may want to consider more than just a generator in the future. But like I said, I love the city too much to leave. I accept the risk profile. And that, as we've seen, is the heart of the matter that we all face. Home is home until you don't have one. Thanks for listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. For information on this episode, please visit our website, progressivereform.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, @CPRblog. Or check us out on Instagram, @progressivereform, all one word. If you like this podcast, please subscribe, leave us a great review. It will help us to reach more listeners like you who want to connect the dots in today's most pressing times. I'd like to thank our guests today, Daryl Fairweather, Philip Mulder, Sean Hecht, Matt Kahn, as well as our producer, Courtney Garcia, and our assistant producer, Maggie Duane. Our theme music is by Lobo Loco and Blue Dot Sessions. And I'm Rob Virchik. Until next time, be safe and take care of one another.